Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. If you'd like a signed copy, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop. They deliver nationwide. Also, I'm very excited to tell you about my new novel, Careering, coming in March. It's an office rom-com where the love interest is the job itself. Waterstone says, Careering is a caustically funny take on modern womanhood, a hilarious dark comedy about two magazine employees who stage a chaotic rebellion against the jobs that have sucked them dry. Your Book listeners can pre-order their copy from Waterstones right now. It's a great present for future you and the very best way to support the podcast. Now on to today's guest, the poet and novelist Ben Okri, OBE. A Booker Prize winner for The Famished Road in 1991, he's written for the screen, stage and page. His latest book, Every Leaf a Hallelujah, a collaboration with the illustrator Diana Ejoto, is a moving environmental fairy tale for children and adults. We discussed Proust, Walt Whitman, and the nature of reality itself. I really wanted to ask you about something you said in an interview a couple of years ago. When you are hungry, it seems all the books you're reading are full of feasts. And I would love to hear about any books with feasts that you find remarkable or great reading or great eating.
Books with food in them. What I'm reading at the moment is kind of working my way through the lengthy Meditations of Proust. I'm on volume 3 of A la Recherche, and that's full of food in a kind of indirect way. It doesn't describe or talk about food directly, but people are often at feasts and at dinners, and he does like actually describing food being as it's prepared, as it's laid out on the table, not so much the preparation of it. I don't think he's that much interested in the preparation, although he does have a housekeeper who, you know, has a particular market she goes to get very special ingredients for the family cooking. So there's a great sense of gastronomy and of pleasures of food, and he makes relationship between that and reading and the text in some way. There's a delicious eatability about the way he describes not just food, but, you know, clothes, parties and people.
I love that idea of the text being edible. And I think that if the collection were reissued tomorrow with you on the cover saying there's a delicious eatability to this, millions of new readers would discover Proust. And to my shame, I know the bits that everyone knows, like the Madeleines, but I've never actually read A la Recherche de Tombouctou. I'd love to hear about what made you pick the book up. Have you been reading those volumes for a while?
Yeah, when you read A la Recherche, you make a kind of a It seems like a lifetime's commitment because they're just so many volumes, and each volume is vast. And he writes in a very, well, semi-poetic way, with kind of rich, long sentences. They require a great deal of attention, and it seems difficult at the time you're reading it, and sometimes even seems slightly punitive. But actually, when you're not reading it, you really do miss being in the richness of that world. It's a very, very, very strange, very, very strange thing. It doesn't feel like it when you're reading, but he immerses you in a world that you cannot get to in any other way. And it's not just the world as in France, or France in a particular time. It's also the world of his mind. It's the world of his sensibility. It's the world of the way he sees things. And he sees things in extremely unusual ways. He's a realist, but there's an edge of kind of romantic poetry about the way he writes and about his mind. He's also an extremely perceptive human being. And every page is rich with kind of indirect wisdom in a way. It's a very, very strange book. It's not a page turner, but it is a mind turner.
Ooh, I love that description, and I really love the idea of reading a book. And I've had those moments where something feels quite dense and quite laboured, and I've got to read the same sentence 4 or 5 times, and I think, oh, it's not going in, and I'm stupid. And then I go away from it and I think, oh no, it's haunting me. I'm still thinking about this. I can't stop thinking about it. It's a tension there, I think, but a really great tension. Are you reading other things at the same time as you read A la Recherche, or does it have your full attention? When I say at the same time, I don't mean, you know, simultaneously, but in terms of in your general reading life.
Thoughts, yes, to be reading 2 books at the same time, which I'm sure people do. I knew a professor who, you know, walking across the lawn would be seen actually reading 2 books, had a book in one hand. It's like he couldn't make up his mind which book he wanted to be in. Very striking image for me of the temptations of reading.
I'd love to know what those 2 books were.
Oh, I think one was a medieval novel, and the other was some Latin. Yes, I would like to know too. But I think one was on Scipio Africanus. That's right. They were very dense books. They were not sort of like modern detective novels, unfortunately.
Could you sort of want, you know, to be like, you know, Charles Dickens in one hand and the Beano in the
other? That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Shakespeare in one hand, and what would your equivalent be for Shakespeare?
Well, I was thinking it'd be a sort of a contrast, so some kind of comic, or, you know, the novelisation.
Not a graphic novel.
Yeah, but although I think, you know, there are some graphic novels that are very sort of well written and profound. And your new book, Every Leaf, Hallelujah, the illustrations are just so beautiful and bright, and they really work so well with the text. And I really wanted to know about your relationship with the artist and Diana, how you came to work with her, and if you were sort of introduced, or if you knew that she was the person that you wanted to make this book with.
Diana's I didn't know Diana at all. I only know her work from the New Yorker. She's an illustrator at the New Yorker. The question came up as to who was going to illustrate this book, even before I started to write it. And it was clear that we had to have the person in mind before I wrote a word. Not that what they did would in any way influence, but I think it just helped in some way to know the personality of the person who's going to be transfiguring your work, because that's what they do. They sort of, you know, illustration. I think if you know your work has been illustrated, you do write in a slightly different way. And I love her spirit as it comes through her work. We researched a lot of her work, and I just knew immediately that she's the one I wanted to work with. It's very expressive, but it's also something slightly fragmentary, slightly incomplete, sometimes elongated, very, very, very affected by certain African batik traditions. There's a way of elongation. There's a way of a combination of the morphologies of bodies. There's just a way that she draws human beings and animals. It's not realistic at all. That I loved, and I just felt that partnering that with the kind of story I was telling really would be wonderful. And I've spoken to her a few times, and she comes across quite differently from her work. She's very gentle. Her work is gentle too, but there's a kind of rangy, extravagant quality. What did you like about her work?
I think that on the page, I love those shapes and those curves, and it complements your words so well because there's something really propulsive about it. It's that feeling of being pulled in, and it's elegant and playful and bold all at once. And there's a confidence to it, and it doesn't shout, but it speaks. And, you know, what you were saying about this, fierce isn't quite the word, and it doesn't overwhelm, but there's a really clear sense of it. And even though sort of stylistically, I mean, I don't really know as nearly as much about art or illustration as I'd like, but, you know, every page does look so very different. It almost feels like there are, if I was sort of, you know, browsing in a bookshop and, you know, looking at different pages, the styles aren't sort of obviously all alike, and yet they really do sort of sit together so beautifully. And there is a sense of breadth and range, much like a tree or in nature, that, you know, you can sort of, you find multitudes and so many things that are so very different, but they're all united in the same space, and that, you know, a plant or a tree or anything living can host so many different lives.
I think it also helped that she was, I hope she doesn't mind my saying this, that she was pregnant with her daughter at the time she was working on this. So there was a sense of, there's a double sense of fertility, the fertility of nature and of motherhood, I think, that really informed her illustration. We talked about that a lot. And she was very conscious of it. She kept referring to it. Have you ever experienced or spoken to people who've experienced that kind of simultaneous condition?
I know that this, you know, the sort of fecundity in making something, and I wonder if that's where, that's part of the confidence of it, that when you are, I would guess, you know, embracing the sort of, you know, motherhood and pregnancy and going on that journey, you've got to be, I think, sure and confident and resilient for
the
person who's coming. You've got to be brave in a way that maybe we can't always be brave for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, back to books, I really wanted to ask you about something else. I read that, but I believe you said that your father, he was very keen on having books at home for you to read.
No, he's a classicist and a lawyer, and he's a great, great reader. And and had a terrific library, which he brought back to Nigeria with him.
And you took that library all the way from London, is that right?
Yeah, of course. If you have a great library in London, you're going back to Nigeria, what will you do with it? Bring it back with you. Because it's invested with your... with your travels, your time there, books have that quality, don't they? They absorb the space in which they've been, and they carry it with them. You know, I know people who, you talk about books that they've read, that they've enjoyed, and they say, oh yes, I bought that book in Japan, or I bought that book in New York. The place that they bought the book is in a way part of the feeling and the reading and the memory of the actual book itself. So I think for Dad, it was important. I felt that. So the book was invested with England, even when it was in Nigeria.
I was wondering about the books that he was the most passionate about sharing with you, and the first books you read that your father, you know, had read and loved and wanted you to read.
No, our tastes were very different. When he went back to Nigeria, I was still very young. I was about 6, 7, 8, and he went straight back into professional life as a lawyer in Nigeria, and I wasn't really in any way allowed to sort of read his books. It was my job at the time, as he told it to me, was not to read the books, but to dust them, because books in Nigeria tend to gather a lot of dust, and my job was to dust them and not to read them. I remember that specific instruction. And for years afterwards, I've often wondered whether It was a deliberate ploy on his part, telling me not to read them but to dust them, thereby inducing in me a kind of curiosity, making them somewhat forbidden and therefore making them interesting. I don't know, but I had an excellent collection of Dickens, Shakespeare, all the classical works that you'd expect. Really, it's from him I got my sense of the classical. You know, the Greek classics, the Romans, because he read Greek and Latin. He was of that generation. I think it was the Greeks that I inherited from him directly. Plato and Aristotle. He loved his Plato. We used to have long arguments about the things. I remember growing up, I'd read one of the dialogues and I'd just start arguing with Dad about what constitutes being, whether there was an chair out of which all other chairs were made, and where ideas came from, and stuff like that. So in terms of what I got from Dad as a direct reading legacy, I would say it's the Greeks, not the Greek playwrights, more the Greek philosophers.
I think it's incredible how, as you know, what you were saying about place, and that we always think of where we found our books as well as how we found our books and what's in them. But also, you know, those people that when you've got a reader in your life and you have those conversations, whenever you read those books or see those books, you bring those people to the experience with you as well. Have you changed your mind about anything in Plato? Is there anything that your father argued and you've now come around to his way of thinking? Or are you still quite sure in what you were initially setting out to say?
I think a really transforming moment for me was arguing about the nature of reality with Dad, and about philosophy in general, about the philosophizing nature of different nations, because I'd already graduated. I'd also read a lot of modern philosophy, well, modern at the time. And I was asking him about the nature of reality and how we know that things are there and that they exist, what proof we have of the reality of things, because I was just fascinated at the time by what constitutes reality, as I still am. And I remember him saying to me, "Oh, but it's not just the Greeks. We have our philosophers too, who deal with reality." I remember him saying. And I said, "Oh," I was very surprised. I says, "Oh, really? We have our Platos?" He says, "Oh, yes, of course." And I says, "Where?" And I was expecting him to give me a list of names, which he could very well have given. There are many excellent African philosophers. But that's not what he meant. He meant something else. He made a gesture that included the air. And I remember looking around and I didn't see anything that he was referring to. And I thought he was just using a Dad thing to bring an argument to a close. And the years went by. I was in London, learning to write, trying to write about certain realities back home in Nigeria, finding it difficult using the methods that we've been taught. And I remember that gesture, and I knew exactly, away from home, what he meant. And he meant that there's a different order of reality. I said, there's a different order of reality that I should be aware of. And I knew what he meant. And that began a major transformation in the way I wrote. But it took a while to find the right kind of tone in which to incorporate that. He meant that the philosophers that I needed, they're in the space, they're in the air, they're part of the spiritual tradition of the land. Yeah, does that make sense to you, Daisy?
It does. It really does. And I think it's the most extraordinary gift a person can give you. And I think books often do that too, where the lessons and the wisdom, you know, initially it's hard to configure it and hard to understand it. And then there is a moment later where everything clicks and it's, you know, it's like something kind of blooming or bearing fruit, you know, long after it was initially planted, but it just happens, you know, at the right moment. I think that's an incredible memory. And I'd love to hear about which authors do you think have taught you the most about storytelling?
Well, we'll have to go back to Homer, I'm afraid. My first reading of the Odyssey was alarming in what it made me aware of what was possible. There was a simplicity. There is a simplicity that is extremely rich and extremely difficult at the same time that Homer has. When you begin to read something like the Odyssey, well, whatever translation you choose to read it, doesn't really matter, really, whether you read it in verse or whether you read it in a prose translation. We're talking about storytelling. The way they're able to sort of, the way Homer, some say it's a group of people, individual, where is able to configure a world with such simplicity of means, still remains, to my mind, kind of staggering, actually. We get more complex, we get more complicated, we pile on descriptions, we pile on our phrases. But a quarrel and someone's response to that quarrel. And already armies are out there on the shore of a land in which you can see towers and people behind their walls, terrified of these invaders, these soldiers who are camped out there. And been camped out there for 10 years. This is the Iliad, or the Odyssey. Odysseus with his men on the way back, and constantly being hassled and diverted by gods and goddesses who are against them. And yet, this is a simple story of homecoming. Yeah, Homer really illuminated for me how rich and how multidimensional true storytelling can be. And I think it's because it reminded me of my African universe. It was a very close parallel to the world that I grew up in, which is a world of gods and ancestors, a world in which the dead are present and are sometimes summoned and spoken to, and in which, you know, you can't tell a story that doesn't pass through all these realms. Sometimes the oldest are the best. Strangely enough.
Absolutely. And it sounds as though that really chimes with, you know, what your father was saying about there being so much more to, you know, reality and the question of what is.
Absolutely.
When were you reading the Odyssey?
Yeah, I read the Odyssey as a child in London in a very, very simplified version. And I think I just read the Odyssey. I read the Odyssey and the Iliad through all the different permutations of reading ages all through my life. And my daughter's doing the same thing now. She's not yet five, but from about three, four, she was already reading tales from Homer, of the Odyssey and the Iliad. And when she's about 10, like me, she'll read a different version for that age. And when she's about 15, 16, she'll read the adult version. And that's how I've always been reading Homer. It's been one of the great constants in my reading life. There's a moment in the Iliad when Achilles just walks away from a group of people, and the air about him changes, and he looks to the side, and there's his mother, a goddess. She just seemed to appear out of the air, and Homer doesn't bat a pen lid, if you can accept this new phrasing. Doesn't bat an eyelid in that. There's no stylistic stress in making that reality work on the page. There's no sweat at all. It just happens, and she's there, and they have a conversation. Absolutely incredible. You read that now, and you realize how difficult that would be for us to do with simple conviction, not great conviction, because too much conviction really does mean that you don't really believe it.
I know what you mean, and I think children, you know, when we're children, we read so wisely, because there are places where I think we sort of demand detail, but there are, you know, so often if something is told with the right amount of clarity and gravity, as a child you think, well, yes, of course, and you embrace those details without questioning. It's only when we're older that other things start to creep in. Which books are you really excited about sharing with your daughter, or that you've shared with her already, other than The Odyssey?
Well, I'm absolutely delighted that she loves The Odyssey and loves Homer. Shakespeare, you see, the thing is, I never had books forced on me. I never had books suggested to me in that way. Books were just around and I discovered them. And that's how I am with her. I just let the books be around and leave it to her curiosity and to her interest. Nothing beats the natural curiosity of people, really. Nothing beats the direction that one's heart goes when one is discovering books for oneself. Almost all my great discoveries, my great reading discoveries, were mostly accidental. Very few of them have come from other people. When people say, oh, you should read this book, it's really, really, really wonderful. It doesn't often really work for me. I have to go in a roundabout way to make my discoveries. When I go to a bookshop, I never go to the books recommended. I just wander around and go into corners. I look at books that are, odd, books that are, one finds one's own way, but there just has to be a way there to be found, if you know what I mean.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We'll be back to Ben soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Wonder, a poetry collection edited by Anna Sampson in collaboration with the Natural History Museum. When the world has seemed especially difficult to live in, I have turned to this book and been moved and delighted by it. Poets include Ruth Owolola, Sylvia Plath, and Gerard Manley Hopkins, all celebrating the majestic and the delicate. Wonder, edited by Anna Sampson and published by Macmillan, is out now. Now, back to Ben.
What was the last book you found and bought in a bookshop?
Oh, I don't know. I found wonderful editions of Chartreuse du Parme, Stendhal. I found lovely, it was a lovely biography of Walt Whitman. Nobody would recommend that really here.
Oh, tell me about that, because I love his poetry, but I know very little about him other than, the sort of what we all think we know.
Yeah, well, Walt Whitman is a most interesting case, because it's not what people think at all. And this biography is by Paul Zweig. It's called The Making of a Poet. And I think it came out, about 10, 15 years ago. And it just completely rearranges your perception of Mr. Whitman, because he's actually someone who actually invented his persona. He invented himself because he's a journalist. And this book just goes through quite carefully, quite rigorously, all the pieces that he wrote, his journalistic pieces, and assembled from that a different kind of portrait of Walt. And apparently a lot of his journalism were kind of a blind for the accumulation of details that he needed for Leaves of Grass. So it was actually trying to locate the poet through the journalist, which I think is interesting but inconclusive, because you can never really locate a poet even through the methods by which to accumulate the elements of their poetry. You still have to look somewhere else. So it's a very factual investigation of the sources of the poetry, looking for evidence of it outside of the man, outside of the poet.
You Can Never Locate a Poet would be a great title for a book. And I love this idea of that enigma. And I really loved The Lonely City by Olivia Lang. I don't know if you've read that book, but she talks about different artists in New York and their experience of living in New York in the sort of the mid to late 20th century. And I know lots of people have written lots of things about Andy Warhol, but I think she really captures this, the myth-making and the vulnerability and how he chose to live as a cartoon and sort of built this carapace. And yeah, you know, I was completely wrong about Walt Whitman, because I thought he was this, you know, poet who was absolutely in tune with nature. But and you know, that was sort of how he wanted to express himself the most. But I'm really curious now about this man who, you know, sort of built himself and chose how we remembered him. And as a poet, do you feel better or perhaps more equipped to kind of, you know, look for clues, or, you know, to understand the mysteries of poetry and other poets? Or is it a wholly subjective enterprise?
No, it's a wholly doomed enterprise. just forget it. I've read so many biographies and so many meditations on T.S. Eliot, on Yeats, on Christopher Okigbo, and they don't get anywhere. They're just good to read because they give you additional pleasures when you go back to the poetry, but reveal absolutely nothing about how they came to write those poems. I think it's an impossible task, because poetry is partly happens in a magic place inside consciousness, stimulated by some minor or major facts or event outside of oneself. What is located on the outside just bears absolutely no relation at all. That T.S. Eliot was having a nervous breakdown doesn't begin to explain the wasteland at all. So I think the thing to do is really, unfortunately, just to live in the verse, live in the work, incarnate the beauty and the complexity. In short, reread.
Go to the original source.
Yeah, dwell in it.
I'd love to know if there are any sort of contemporary poets or new poets or young poets that you'd like to read. I was going to say that you'd recommend to me and the listeners. I know how you feel about having things recommended to you, so perhaps you wouldn't want to recommend back, but I would be very curious and interested to hear about any new voices that you found lately that you're enjoying.
Well, what I would say, as being very averse to recommendations, is there's so many magazines, podcasts, magazines of young Black poets, young Black writers, young modern poets. There's a whole extraordinary scene of rap poetry that is alive right now, and people should just expand their tastes. People always, the reason I find recommendations not working is because you're passing on your sensibility and your particular taste onto someone else whose tastes and sensibilities are different. I think to encourage people to just look outside their normal world, and I say this with a certain kind of poignancy because I'm so aware of how people read within their class, within their nations. It's one of the most depressing things about the world for me. You meet people, you start a conversation, and they only read themselves. They read their class, they read their nations, they read their upbringing. Their tastes are, you know, fully formed by their cultures. It's very hard to get people to shift and to fall in love with something outside of that. It's rare people who are genuine explorers and adventurers in the art of reading. And I've been around, and I say it with sadness. So for me, it's not a specific recommendation, but just simply to read outside your normal boundaries, read outside your universe, read outside the world that you know. But then it's probably a futile thing because I've been saying this for years and it's done absolutely nothing.
I interviewed Britt Bennett recently, and Britt said in the interview, the way that we talk about, especially sort of, you know, well-meaning white people wanting to read black writers, and she was saying, it's not like eating a broccoli, you know, don't read because it's sort of virtuous and worthy, you know, read as far outside, you know, your sort of background, and, you know, don't read yourself and go beyond, because that's where the excellence is, that if you don't do it, you're going to miss so many really, really stunning, brilliant books. Reading is what will save us all, that we have to, reading is the only way that we can understand each other and, you know, and listen to each other before we speak.
Yes, I totally agree. But what I was saying wasn't in relation to race, because I'm saying this, I'm saying this, you know, aware of friends in Nigeria who only read Nigerian books, and friends in African-American friends who just tend to read just African-American books. I think it's just familiarity, really. But I think it's a lazy familiarity, because the very nature of reading itself already presumes the elasticity of the mind's power to imagine things, you know, beyond its experience. And it's that more than anything else. It's not so much missing brilliant books. It's just simply expanding one's humanity, really. Expanding one's powers of empathy. It's expanding one's sense of the horizons of the world, have them shifted and pushed back a little bit. I think reading is not just kind of like fundamental to civilization. I think it's crucial to being human.
No, I agree entirely. I think that's very, very wise. And I'm a person who I often, you know, I read for comfort.
What do you mean when you say you read for comfort, Daisy?
It's because I've, you know, books I love, especially books that I read as, you know, a child or a young person, that evoke particular feelings, and I want to be pulled back into those feelings and into that world. And I try to make sure that's not the only reason I read, and that's not, you know, true of every book I read. But I think that, you know, especially perhaps because everyone has been through this very difficult time collectively, and we're all looking for different, you know, ways to self-soothe. And I think there are lots of readers who, you know, at the moment, those are the books that we're reaching for. And it takes different forms, you know. I think there are lots of people who were suddenly in the throes of the pandemic, like, you know what I'm going to read? I'm going to read Camus. I'm going to read The Plague.
And they don't, right?
No, I think some people were, they thought it could be worse. It could be like in The Plague. One of the things I love about fiction, especially, is there can be as much sort of sociological truth in fiction as in nonfiction. And it reminds us that most of our problems have existed in some form for hundreds of years. And it's sort of, you know, back to the Odyssey. And the reason, you know, I think that we're talking about it and that your daughter is reading it is that thematically, that is what stays with us. Maybe we are reading for comfort more than we have, and staying in that comfortable place and not wanting to challenge ourselves so much, because we've all been through something quite challenging, quite real together.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in your theory, actually, because I know a lot of people who wanted to read, as it were, to match the experience they were going through. They wanted to read their Dostoevsky's, wanted to read their, you know, their plague books, and started with, you know, really good intentions, but actually segued to things that warmed them, things that made them feel made them feel safe. But you know, the curious thing about even books that are written about very tough experiences like the war or plague is that and I got this was something I a perception I got that was stimulated by a conversation that Margaret Atwood had. She was in conversation recently for the Penn Congress, and they were talking about books that are very rarely as horrible as the things that they write about. And I was struck by that I think it's the nature of the human spirit that even if you're writing about years of imprisonment or, you know, a plague or people dying or a massacre, that the writing itself can never be as bad as the reality. And I think it's because the very nature of writing, it's like painting. We introduce a film, a quality over this terrible experience that makes it possible for us to read it. So by that, I mean, the very act of transfiguring a horrible experience into story is already to sprinkle on it the sugar quality of the pill, or is already to sprinkle over it that which makes it possible for us to read it. So it has been simplified, it's been removed a little bit, in fact, considerably, from the horribleness of the experience. And that's what happens when raw experience gets translated into story, into literature. It's as if there is something in us that understands that the rawness of experience can be too much, that it needs something around it by which we can begin to approach that experience, but never really enter into it in all of its horribleness. Does any of this make sense?
Absolutely, it really does. And I think, you know, once again, we're back to what exists and what is real and what is fact, because I think so much horror is in the anticipation and the way something is felt and the way it is experienced. I think so many of the most awful, dreadful things the human being goes through, it's about the pure imagining of it, even seconds before it happens. And the only way it can be captured on a page is at a remove. You can read about a horror and you can empathize and imagine as hard as you possibly can, but you can never really have that pure dread sense of not just being in that moment, but being in the raw anticipation of that moment. And Ellen Montgomery said something, and I'm going to paraphrase horribly, about the most glorious, most awful thing about writing is nothing can ever be as wondrous or magical or as crushing and painful on paper as it was when it was in your head in the first place.
Well, except the reality. You know, if you've been in a concentration camp, or if you've been in prison for say 5 years, and you've gone past the anticipation and you're living in the daily grind of that, when you actually come to write about it, what is in your head is less than what you went through. So the reality of it can be a damn sight worse than what's in your head. But what's in your head when you come to write it temporizes it somewhat. That is the thing that I find extremely fascinating, because the day-to-day, if you've been in prison for 5 years, the waking up in the morning, the day-to-dayness, the moment-by-momentness of it can only be lived through. Once it's lived through in one's being, it becomes this massive experience. You can't break down into those seconds anymore. Do you get what I'm trying to say?
I think so. I mean, I think that we've got humans have a very, very interesting relationship with time and with hope. And I think two humans can experience the same circumstances and the same set of events in an entirely different way. But I do see what you mean. If you have been through that horror and you are writing about it, as the author of your experience, you're perhaps in charge of it and in charge of how much you reveal and how you relive it in a way that you had no control over when it was actually happening.
Also, it has become, it's the way in which experience gets transformed in one's being afterwards. So if you're writing about it, presumably you've survived it. And if you've survived it, it means that you have simplified it in your being in some way, because otherwise you'd have gone mad. So whether it's people who've lived in famine, whether it's people who've lived through civil war, whether people who've lived through whatever it is, but the minute you've survived it, it's very hard to go back to the day-by-day horribleness of it. So it's as if the mind simplifies, abstractifies this horrible experience. And the real difficulty is actually then going back to relive in order to write about it. But in doing that, you're already simplifying the outlines of what was unbearable. It's a very, very, very strange thing. And so writing itself is a generous act of the forgiving of one's experience, if it's horrible, and a multiplication of it in some way if it's not.
Oh, that is beautifully put and very moving. I really, really like that idea. Thank you so much for being so generous and thoughtful and interesting and for all of these incredible responses. I think this has been much more sort of wide-ranging and philosophical than any interview I've done on this podcast before. Before we go, I'd love to hear if there's anything other than the Proust that you are excited about reading or looking forward to reading, if there's anything. I don't know if you have a book pile.
Well, I got five more volumes of the Proust. Each one is about 600-700 pages, so you need to come talk to me in about 2 years' time. I think it'll take me about two, three years.
Focusing on the Proust at the moment.
Yeah, I go to bed with him. I kind of wake up with him. I read bits of him through the day. I'm just completely in that world. It's what happens with a long novel. With a short novel, you can't quite get that feeling unless you read very, very, very slowly, which I love doing as well. Like sometimes a paragraph a day. But with really, really long books by, you know, someone whose mind is someone who's interested in everything from buttons to the constellation, from how needles are made to the extraordinary nature of women's dresses, and he was with such a mind. You're not reading for pleasure. You're just reading to find out how the mind is, how this person's mind is working today on this new movement of this amorphous story. You're not reading for story. You're reading for something actually more fascinating than story.
So perhaps if we've all got into our reading comfort zones and we want to get out of them after the last year and a bit, we all need to start reading A La Recherche.
Well, now that's a big adventure. Maybe it's time you took your first step into Proust land.
I think you're right. I think I'm ready. I'm definitely, I know... you're not taking recommendations and you're not giving recommendations.
Absolutely
not. But I feel
not.
Like that's a strong recommendation.
It's not a recommendation. I'm just offering you a drink.
I am. Well, I'm accepting with alacrity. Ben, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's been lovely talking to you, Daisy.
Huge thanks to Ben. Every Leaf, Hallelujah is published by Head of Zeus and out now. You can follow us at YBooked on social media, look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends. Thank you so much to everyone who has left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Ben at acast.com/booked and check out his selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from Renata Adler. That writers write is meant to be self-evident. People like to say it. I find it is hardly ever true. Writers drink. Writers rant. Writers phone. Writers sleep. I've met very few writers who write at all. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.